This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It was the second week of January, and this week, President Trump was impeached again. The House voted to impeach the president 1 week after his supporters ransacked the Capitol building in a riot that led to 5 deaths. That riot intending to interrupt the process of certifying Joe Biden as the winner of last November's election. The impeachment vote was the most bipartisan impeachment vote in American history, with 10 Republicans joining every Democrat in the House voting to impeach Trump for inciting an insurrection against the U.S. government. Mitch McConnell has declined to call the Senate back into session early, so the trial won't likely happen until after Trump has left office next week. But most legal experts believe the Senate can hold an impeachment trial after an official has left office. Indeed, this has been done before for federal judges who were impeached. And that the Senate can vote to bar President Trump from ever holding federal office again, if it so chooses. So shortly, that question will be with the Senate, where a number of Republicans have expressed openness to the impeachment, and even Mitch McConnell is telling Associates he's undecided on what verdict he would vote for. There was much less Republican support for the president's election objections in the Senate than there had been in the House, possibly making it fertile ground for Democrats to find bipartisan support. To talk about all of that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. On the right, Lonnie Chen is the David and Diane Steffi Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's the Director of Domestic Policy Studies at Stanford. Hello, Lonnie.
Good to be with you, Josh.
On the left is Sabil Rahman, President of Demos. Hi, Sabil.
Hi, Josh.
And our special guest today is Zeynep Tufekci. Zeynep is a sociology professor at the University of North Carolina and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Zeynep.
Hi there.
So, Sabil, what is the objective with this impeachment?
So, Josh, I think it's such an extraordinary circumstance here. Impeachment, to my mind, is such an important marker of accountability, right? What happened last week remains an attack on the Capitol, an attack on our democratic process. And I think to let it go by unnoticed and unnoted is a huge mistake for our long-term democracy. This is not about just about backward-looking accountability. I think this is really about sending a strong signal for the future, right? Because we want to make sure that this isn't a precursor to further attempts to destabilize our democratic process in future years. So it's really, really important that there be a strong response from the government.
Lonnie, I keep hearing many Republicans this week saying that impeachment is divisive and it won't bring the country together at this moment, and basically that we should look forward and not backward. And I just find this amazing coming from a political party that has fomented all of these lies about the election that were extremely divisive, that led to this mob sacking the Capitol building. They were told that a huge crime was being committed against American democracy, in which Republicans were complicit with Democrats trying to steal this election from Donald Trump. And so, you know, I can understand the political dynamics that ended up with a lot of Republicans doing this. I just find it amazing to do that for months and months and months, and then come around and say that an impeachment trial would be divisive. So why is that the argument that Republicans have to hang their hat on here? They're not substantively defending the president's behavior. A lot of them are even stipulating to the fact that he committed impeachable offenses and just basically saying, well, you know, the country needs to move on from this. It doesn't feel like that's something that's likely to be acceptable to the rest of the country.
What we know is when there aren't great substantive arguments, one does tend to default to process arguments. And I think we saw this also. I mean, by the way, this is something that I think is kind of native to our politics now. And we saw it also, you know, Republicans during the first impeachment proceeding back in January, a number of them were throughout. For example, if you recall the controversy over whether John Bolton ought to testify, you know, a lot of those substantive arguments in favor of that were drowned out by process arguments. And so, you know, I think process arguments are generally what one goes to when the substance isn't great. And as you noted, the stipulation that many Republicans have made, and in fact, it is the right stipulation, is that President Trump played a not insignificant role in the proceedings that we saw at the Capitol building. So the challenge then becomes, how do you put together an argument for essentially opposing this process going forward? And I do think a lot of it does come to this. And look, you can say some of it is process, and I understand that. But there are some legitimate constitutional questions regarding, you know, whether in fact this process is appropriate for a former president, which is what it will be once this process does get going. If the purpose of the process is to effectuate a bar on President Trump from ever running for public office again, or ever holding public office again, I should say. I think people should be clear about that, and they should say that that's in fact what the intention is, rather than trying to cloak it in this conversation about removing him from office, which is going to be a relatively academic one come January 20th at 12:01. It is also not inaccurate to say that it is a divisive process. It is a divisive process, and in some ways, that's the challenge with impeachment. Is impeachment is a political argument. It's not a legal one. And efforts to make it a legal one really, in some ways, I think, take away from the reality of the fact that all of this is happening in a massively political environment. People will have their own opinions about whether it's right or wrong, but the reality is that it is a political argument we're having, not a legal one.
Zeynep, do you see this as a useful remedy in the situation? And I know you've written in the last few days that the most dangerous thing that happened at the Capitol on January 6th was after the sacking of the Capitol. It was Republicans in the House of Representatives lining up to attempt to steal the election for the president, standing by these conspiracy claims that they have made. I mean, impeachment does not directly have an impact on them or on the Republican Party more broadly. So in your view, how far does this go in terms of actually trying to impose accountability?
Yeah, so I think, impeaching him is clearly one way to impose accountability on him. But as you said, I think that's like the least of our problems at the moment, because he is on his way out one way or another in disrepute. The problem is, right after all that mayhem and right after, you know, people died, about 66% of the House GOP caucus, that's 139 representatives, an overwhelming majority, two-thirds of them, went back and objected to the results of the legitimate election, and their objections were ridiculous to nonsense. It was just what the mob had demanded. It's what the president had demanded. And I realize, politically speaking, this is a very difficult thing to say that, you know, what do we do about it? When a majority of the party is going along with the mob, going along with the president's attempt to steal the election. But I feel like focusing too much on Trump, who is clearly the leader of this movement, but on the way out, at the expense of realizing that this is his party now and these are his representatives who support him, kind of takes us away from realizing the gravity of the situation. Plus, tens of millions of people believe this now. They believe that the election was stolen, that it was this massive fraud, and that the incoming president is the head of this massive fraud. That big political problem is just staring at us without a solution at the moment.
Lonnie, do you want to respond to that? Republicans had been, I think, preparing to do this complicated two-step where they wanted to keep the new people that President Trump had brought into the political process. He got 12 million more votes in 2020 than he got in 2016. I wanted to find ways to keep those people engaged and energized in the party at the same time that they could maybe appeal to some of the groups that Trump had alienated. And I think the problem here is that a key part of what the president did to activate those people was to spin a series of lies and conspiracy theories that the party showed that it could not make good on in the past couple of weeks. So, you know, if you believed that Vice President Pence had the ability to change the election result, if you believed that there had been this conspiracy to steal the election on behalf of Donald Trump, we've just watched Republicans not do anything about that. So where does that leave the party? Is there a recognition that two-step is impossible?
Yeah, I think there are a few questions that are part of this. I mean, the first challenge is really figuring out what voters, you know, you do have a number of voters who voted Republican, who voted for Trump, who voted Republican really probably for the first time in their lives or probably for the first time in a while. And the question is, you know, how much of that was really about Donald Trump himself versus about some grander vision the Republican party was selling? I mean, obviously, it seems like like President Trump has a personal following, and the degree to which you can separate that from the president. In other words, could you take those voters who really were out there to support Trump and now say, okay, well, we want you to support Republicans in the future? I'm just not convinced that there is a Trumpism without Trump. I'm not convinced that the Republican Party can successfully say, well, because we're tough on trade and anti-immigration and anti-China, because we're all those things, now you're going to support Republicans in the future. I know there's an effort to intellectualize Trumpism. To me, it just always falls a little bit short, because I think at the end of the day, what a lot of these voters were responding to was Trump himself. And without Trump, I think it's going to be very difficult to sell elements of that message. I'm not convinced that the Republican Party can sustain the support of those people who really, at the end of the day, were in it for Trump. And now that Trump is gone and will do his own thing, whatever that might be, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, I think it's going to be very much more difficult for the Republican Party to hang on to those people, even if they accept elements of the so-called Trump agenda.
And Sabeel, where does this leave Democrats? Joe Biden, coming into office, they're going to be trying his predecessor basically right as he takes office, which is a pretty unusual situation, unprecedented, in fact. And there are some negotiations about the Senate calendar and trying to find ways so that the Senate can start confirming Joe Biden's cabinet nominees and working on coronavirus legislation, which we'll talk about later in the show, at the same time that they hold this trial. But then, you know, the incoming Biden administration says that they don't want to use the budget reconciliation process to move COVID relief, which is to say they want to get 60 votes, at least 10 Republicans in the Senate to join in with them on that. They have a number of policy initiatives that they intend to have be bipartisan. At the same time, as Zainab notes, you had two-thirds of the House Republican conference voting to overturn the results of this election, steal it from Joe Biden and try to give Donald Trump another term. So, I mean, you know, that leaves about 70 Republicans in the House, which is quite a lot of people to work with. Maybe there's more people in the Senate. But how do you do this? These two simultaneous things where Joe Biden is talking about, you know, trying to, you know, return to a more normal, civil, bipartisan politics at the same time that you're trying to deal with a really large fraction of the opposition party having been complicit in what is essentially a coup attempt.
Yeah, it's an enormous challenge. And I think the complicity in the coup attempt piece is so important here, because I do think Zainab's take on the post-Trump landscape is exactly right, that you now do have a self-sustaining ecosystem of an activated base, extremist base, with elected representatives in the Congress as well as in the states, and a right-wing media ecosystem that is still active, right? So I don't think it's just going to vanish when Trump leaves office. And that's a huge challenge for the new incoming Biden administration. I mean, what my read on how they're approaching this, I think they're trying to move on three fronts at the same time. One is an immediate response to the COVID and economic crises to deliver tangible supports and impacts and solutions to try to, you know, kind of right the crises that are actually facing, you know, communities on the ground. But two, I think there is this concern about accountability that we talked about, not just for Trump, but I think going forward, you know, seeing law enforcement now moving through its own process to respond to what happened last week. I think those are promising signs. But then I think the third piece, which we haven't talked about yet, is sort of the prophylactic structural reforms on democracy, right? That there's been a lot of conversation about how do we inoculate our own democratic political process going forward against these types of attacks, whether it's from voter suppression or from, you know, the vagaries of the electoral college system. Now, that's a lot to move. And, you know, I'm sure this is the strategy that there's a strategy that folks in the incoming administration are thinking about. I suspect that, you know, what you're going to see is a lot of maneuvering, right, in the Senate to try to just cram in all these different priorities in the Senate calendar. And so, you know, I don't envy Chuck Schumer his job. It'll be a challenge to move all this through.
I keep wanting to emphasize this, that this is unprecedented, that, you know, two-thirds of a political party voted openly to overthrow and overturn the election, not just in some routine day either, right after the mob had stormed the Capitol and tried to potentially murder their own vice president. This is ludicrous. So the GOP, though, there are people in the party, about 70 in the House, as you noted, and probably some in the Senate, a lot more in the Senate, who clearly recognize this for what it was. Now, I don't really, you know, you don't have to agree with them on, say, tax policy or all the other things. And I realize that there's a tendency to say it's the whole party, but it's not the whole party. Even people like Lindsey Graham, who have done so much to carry water for Trump, were just pretty straightforward when it was being debated, saying you're voting to overturn the election and this is just unprecedented and terrible. And I think right now, the distasteful and unpleasant political step in front of us is to recognize that it's one of those country over party moments where there has to be an alliance that's bipartisan, because there are tens of millions of people who believe the election was stolen. And you can't just say you're stupid and turn your back to them. That is, one, politically crazy. And two, those people have been lied to. It's the fault of the leadership. We have to find a way to get to those people. So there has to be a bipartisan alliance necessary, and there needs to be some sort of reckoning within the GOP. And I think that's what a lot of the GOP leaders are currently debating among them. And I don't think they want to do this, right? They would much rather put it all on Trump and move on.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution, Sabil Rahman of Demos, and Zeynep Tufekci of UNC and The Atlantic. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Lonnie Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Sabil Rahman, president of Demos. And our special guest is Zeynep Tufekci, sociology professor at the University of North Carolina and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Let's talk about voting reform. Lonnie, Zeynep mentioned in there the idea of some sort of grand bargain on voting reforms. And I have been really bearish on the usefulness of any sort of bipartisan voting initiative at the federal level. And the reason for that is that I feel like the Republican calls, whether they are in the form of Ted Cruz saying we need a 10-day quickie commission to investigate the unsubstantiated claims of substantial vote fraud in the states, or other proposals to sort of have some bipartisan vote reform, is that the Republican aims in there tend to be aimed at non-existent problems, where you start from this premise of widespread voting fraud and all sorts of people, showing up the polls and impersonating somebody else and trying to vote, or that, that you have absentee ballots being sent in by fictitious people or that sort of thing. And so any so-called reforms aimed at those things will tend to make the voting process worse rather than better, and won't be a basis for bipartisan support. And I find this sort of depressing, because at the state level, when you have voting system reforms that are not formed in the crucible of divisive national politics, you often do get bipartisan support for things that expand access to the vote.
You sort of hit the nail on the head when you said a lot of them have been started and initiated and really have come through state-based processes. Fundamentally, you can think it's a challenge, but this is the way that our system is that there is largely plenary control given to states over the electoral process. And so states have been able to come up with reforms that have worked well in those contexts. The Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, is talking about pushing H.R. 1, which is this large voting and campaign finance bill, is one of the first priorities of the new Congress. And, H.R. 1 would usurp a lot of these traditionally sort of state-based reform rules, not the least of which is, for example, trying to require or take away, rather, from states the role they have in drawing congressional districts, right, and replacing them with these commissions, which proponents argue are independent, but in reality we've seen probably aren't as independent as they claim to be. So anyway, my point is, states have traditionally taken the lead here. I do think that trying to federalize a lot of this not only wades into some difficult waters from a federalism perspective, but also does get into the more divisive politics and does force people into their corners. Because look, I think you're also right in the sense that there are these assumptions that Republicans feel like they have to make because a lot of these mistruths and lies have been peddled for a while about, you know, about widespread fraud and about widespread problems with the electoral system. And some of that, you know, I think Republicans who, even those who disagree with that, feel like they need to indulge that perspective in order to even have this debate. And that's why I think it is ultimately unproductive to do it at the federal level rather than in state capitals, where we have actually seen some meaningful and actionable reform that have made things better.
Sabeel, what do you make of that?
The fact is, after everything we've been through, I don't see in the long run how our democracy survives without actually stopping some of these loopholes that allow the kind of rampant voter suppression or expansive influence of money in politics. And I just want to correct a few things that Lani said, which I don't think are really accurate. You know, the HR1 is not a usurpation of the state role in election law. It's actually quite consistent with the constitutional authority that Congress has, number one. And number two, I do think that while some democracy reforms have passed in the states, the reality is that over the last few years, it's been state governments that have been the pioneers on rigging our democracy. If you think about what happened in Georgia in 2018, what happened in Wisconsin for the last number of years, what's been happening in Texas and other places, I think the real question is, what is it about the access to the ballot that is so threatening to Republicans that they feel like they can't get on board? Because it really shouldn't be a matter of Democrats versus Republicans. Everybody should be able to vote, and we should have free and fair elections every cycle.
Is there an extent, though, to which one thing I've heard from a lot of liberals over the last couple of months is sort of a newfound appreciation for the decentralized manner in which U.S. elections are conducted. The president's ability to interfere in any of the vote counter certification process was significantly hamstrung by the fact that the federal government doesn't do any of this, and his efforts to lean on state and local officials to do what he wanted were largely unsuccessful. And, you know, you look at what happened in this election and the very high turnout that we saw, including in Georgia, and as the Republican Secretary of State, who has a lot of newfound Democratic fans, is fond of pointing out, you know, Georgia has 16 days of early voting, Georgia has automatic voter registration. It looks to me like there are certain aspects of the state and local election apparatus that are working better than Democrats would have admitted over the previous few years. Now, obviously, you can have federal interventions that are structured in a way that doesn't allow the president to go in and interfere with the election results. I'm not saying that HR1 constitutes a federalization of elections that should worry people necessarily about the concentration of presidential power. But I'm wondering, Sabeel, if you have any newfound appreciation for the way that some of these states have conducted these elections.
Yeah, I think the election administration, civil service, if you will, across the states has done enormously important and heroic work over this last cycle. Secretaries of state, offices, the kind of local offices administering elections. This was a very difficult election, and the fact that the count went off smoothly, fairly, and equitably was, I think, really, really important. So I think that's absolutely right. But I think
and with a high turnout.
And with a high turnout under tough conditions of COVID and, you know, record mail-in balloting and so on. But I think, you know, for our elections to work, you really need three things. You need the actual administration to work. That's the part you're talking about. You need everyone to actually respect the results, even if you lose the election. That's what we were talking about a minute ago with the attempted coup. But you also need policies on the front end that make it make it so that everyone can access the ballot freely and fairly, right? Not having overly restrictive rules kicking people off the rolls or blocking early voting. And I think we need to keep an eye on all three of those in these years ahead.
Zeynep, you've written a fair amount about coups in other countries and about social movements that have brought down governments in other countries. And I'm wondering what you think in terms of how to think about the seriousness of what happened in the country over the last couple of weeks and its future trajectory. In part, you know, we talk a lot about the Republican outrage that led to these violent acts at the Capitol and the extent to which, you know, the president ought to say different things to quiet them down. And I'm wondering about the extent to which this really is controlled from top down. Should we think that, you know, applying elite pressure on the Republican Party to say more of the correct things about this election, such as that it wasn't stolen, the extent to which that would calm this movement versus the extent to which it is self-supporting and self-driving at this point?
So I don't think there's anything that will magically end this, right? So that is clear, but it doesn't mean that, you know, there's nothing to be done. The Republican leaders saying this election was not stolen openly is a crucial step because, one, they're a lot more likely to be believed by the party base than the Democrats saying this. Two, it's ridiculous we're still discussing this, but we have to because, once again, tens of millions of people believe the election was stolen. And until we get through that, there's really no way to get through this political crisis. You cannot get through this without solving representation and voting rights. You cannot have tens of millions of people in the country falsely believe the election was stolen while also having tens of millions of people disenfranchised and lose the ability to have government through representation. Like, these two things cannot coexist in the same way. And, you know, I wish I had like a simpler, sunnier thing to say, but impeaching Donald Trump is not a car that gets you out of this thing.
I want to take a quick break, and then we come back. I want to talk about one thing that has been simmering a little bit less in the last week, which is Donald Trump's social media presence. I have been talking with Zeynep Tufekci of the University of North Carolina, Sabil Rahman of Demos, and Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Sabil Rahman, president of Demos. And our special guest is Zeynep Tufekci, sociology professor at the University of North Carolina and contributing writer at The Atlantic. Lanhee, a defining feature of the last 4 years has been Republican elected officials trembling in fear at the president's Twitter account. And the president has been kicked off of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram because of the role that his public statements, including social media statements, had in fomenting the insurrection that we had at the Capitol building. This is one of several reasons that it's been a quieter week than usual for the president. And I'm wondering about the effect of this on the Republican Party and what this might mean for several years to come now, where there has been this both hope for Republicans to keep the base that the president activated and this fear of what the president will do to people who cross him in one way or another, such as by trying to accept the results of the election in terms of defeating people in primaries and that sort of thing. Are we seeing the president's influence greatly waning? How much of the extent of that is about his social media megaphone being taken away?
I actually do think that it has had an appreciable impact on his ability to not just to communicate with those who support him, but his ability really to control the ecosystem and control the infrastructure around media coverage of him and media coverage of the presidency in a really meaningful way. So I actually do think there will be an impact, certainly in this period of time where his presence has been diminished significantly. Now, I also know this. He is somebody who has demonstrated an ability to reach an audience, and he is going to have the tools and the ability and probably the financial wherewithal to design a platform, whether it's some kind of media network or some kind of a direct-to-consumer marketing scheme. He's going to be able to figure out some way to communicate with people who want to hear from him. I think the diminishing of his voice during this period of time is kind of a temporary thing, and then he'll reestablish some kind of presence. Now, will it be the same as the however many 70 million, I guess, Twitter followers he had before? Probably not. The audience won't be nearly as big. But I'd argue the audience that cares to hear from him won't be nearly as big either. So he is going to have the ability to speak to the audience that he wants to speak to and an audience that's receptive to his message. Now, you can argue that that's actually much more challenging in some ways for the overall enterprise of democratic governance, because it enables him to essentially spread these messages in a relatively less detectable way, right? When he was on Twitter, he'd say it, everyone would see it, and you would know what he was saying. In some ways, this has the potential to be even more pernicious, because he can then have a message that's very much narrow cast that only certain people will see. But I do think that not having that broad influence, not having the ability to drive the narrative in the same way, some of that I do think is going to be relatively lasting, and as we've seen, can be pretty impactful in terms of his ability to control, whether it's other office holders, other politicians, or others in the political environment who he has been able to really have a hold of for the last 4 years.
Zeynep, the actions by the social media platforms go beyond just the president personally. We've seen big purges of QAnon promoting accounts off of Twitter, and actions taken on Facebook that are attempting to stop the spread of various conspiracy theories. Does that look effective to you? Are the steps that are being taken now by the big tech companies, are they appropriate, and are they likely to actually have an effect on our political discourse that is persistent?
Well, obviously, this is a very, very complicated question, but of course they'll be effective. I mean, we know from a lot of past research, deplatforming works. And this particular deplatforming, whatever else you want to think about it, is a very deep one. It includes stack booting from the internet, a lot of these companies. There's really this mistaken understanding that the internet, because it's kind of decentralized in how it communicates with packets, that it roots around censorship. In fact, internet as it works has a lot of really crucial choke points. And Amazon refusing to host Parler is probably a bigger deal than just the president himself not being on social media, along with this kind of purge. Whatever else you want to say about the wisdom of it, it's a very, very powerful tool. Now, is this wise? What else will it do? That's really difficult. Like, to go back to the coup metaphors here, the one thing, like, I come from Turkey, a country of many coups, and the first thing the coup people do is they surround the radio or the TV station or whatever, the media, because, like, if you think about it as factions vying for the public, that megaphone is exactly the crucial thing. Like, the first tanks go to the TV station, and it's the 21st century, and the first thing is not just the TV station, it's social media. Plus, you're seeing that he's not even going on TV, right? The president's, he could go on TV, he's not. It's not the same thing. So on the one hand, I think it's absolutely going to be effective. On the other hand, it's a really weird thing to have a couple of people, Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey and a few other people who died and made them king, do this. And I think it's a cop-out to say, oh, they're just private companies, because they're really big part of the public sphere right now. So even if it's not a First Amendment case in the very strict sense, I think it's definitely a question of free speech and what to do, even if one thinks that at the moment it might have been the right thing to do. So that's, I sound slightly noncommittal, because I don't think there's a quick yes or no to this.
Yeah, Sabil, does that worry you, the way that people effectively like Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg have been elevated in this quasi-political role with their companies making these important decisions about how our politics will be conducted? And if it does bother you, is there an alternative? I mean, Angela Merkel expressed concern about the Twitter ban on Trump this week, but what she said basically was that, it's for the government to make decisions like this, and in countries like Germany, you have speech laws, and that's something that is antithetical to our political culture and by and large prohibited by our constitution as well. So if you don't outsource this to the private companies, what alternative model is there?
Yeah, I think this is a really thorny challenge, and it's going to be one that's going to be with us for the next many years. Two things can be true at the same time, right? That one, that removing Trump's Twitter feed has dramatically helped reduce the risk of further violence and tension. And two, the Jack Dorsey's and Jeff Bezos's and Mark Zuckerberg's of the world should not have that much power over our politics or over our public discourse in general, right? And so I think, to me, what that says is a couple of things. One, I think we do need to have a longer conversation about how we structure and regulate our digital public sphere and these information platforms that, as Zainab said, really are choke points, gatekeepers, controlling so much of how our economy and our politics functions. You know, there's been a lot of conversations, for example, about how do we regulate or manage the kind of algorithms that create the channels of radicalization. And, you know, Zainab's written a lot about that herself. So I do think we need to have a larger conversation about the regulation of the platforms. There's also, I think, an interesting connection here to some of the anti-monopoly conversations that were happening earlier in the summer. You know, the House did a hearing, extensive hearing about Amazon and about some of the other online platforms, more on their economic impact. But I think the degree of centralized control that is potentially problematic, right? I think it's a similar issue that we're seeing show up here.
Before we go, I want to talk about the incoming administration. Joe Biden will be president next Wednesday. Late this week, he put out his proposal for another round of coronavirus economic relief that would include $1,400 checks, topping up the $600 to bring us to the $2,000 amount that President Trump had proposed but had been unable to sell to his Republican colleagues in Congress. There would be an extension of enhanced unemployment benefits through September at a rate of $400 a week. Now, remember, that's an enhancement on top of the base benefits. That would mean that the typical unemployment benefit would be somewhere from $700 to $800 a week for the next 8 months. There would be significant funding for vaccine distribution and testing and reopening schools around the country, aid to state and local governments, enhancement to the child tax credit. The price tag on this is really big, another $1.9 trillion on top of the $900 billion that we did just last month and on top of the CARES Act that we did last spring. But a lot of what's in here is stuff that various Republicans have advocated. You have Marco Rubio out there saying that Joe Biden should lead with the $2,000 checks. There's a lot of Republican support for this child tax credit enhancement. As we discussed on this show a few weeks ago, it was sort of inevitable that there was going to have to be another extension of those enhanced unemployment benefits. Now, you could argue, should the enhancement be $400 a week? Should it be $300 a week? I'm sure there are going to be arguments about the state and local government aid component to this. But is this, you know, given the various statements that Republicans have made, acknowledging the need for another substantial package and advocating for specific components that are going to be in this package, is there going to be significant Republican appetite for negotiating around this and coming to some sort of bipartisan agreement with Joe Biden?
Yeah, I actually think because of the fact that you've got a number of Republicans specifically on the record about the checks as well as other elements of this, it is going to be challenging for them now to turn around and say, you know, that they want to have a protracted negotiation or they want to oppose elements of this. I mean, in the context of the conversations I have around these kinds of issues, you know, I am advising a number of Republicans on, a few policy matters. And my recommendation has always been that when it comes to these sorts of things, when you're talking about assistance related to the pandemic, you really do have to set aside some of the traditional arguments that would be made trying to be more conservative in how you view these things, because we are in the middle of a pandemic, and I think a lot of those rules don't apply. It doesn't mean you throw everything out the window, but it does mean you have to look at these things with a slightly different tint, if you will. Now, there's not everything in this package I think Republicans are going to like, obviously. And for example, you know, the fact that they threw the minimum wage increase in there, I do think irks some Republicans, because Biden could have done a package that would have been entirely bipartisan. But there are a lot of things in here that I think Republicans will agree with and will not want to object to. You know, for example, the additional money in there for vaccine distribution, for COVID testing. We've talked about the checks and the payments, the unemployment aid, the rental assistance and eviction moratorium. I think that's relatively difficult to oppose as well. So I think that in the grand scheme of things, this is a package that will get a lot closer to bipartisan support. And given the time that we're in politically as well, I am optimistic that there will actually be a reasonable number of Republicans who will come over and say, yeah, you know, I think there are a lot of these things that we'll support. I don't think the final package looks exactly like this. I think there are things that probably come out of it. But for the most part, the core elements of this, I do think, will draw at least some bipartisan support.
So, Bill, what's the Democratic strategy here? As we discussed earlier in the show, Joe Biden's not initially intending to use a congressional process that would allow him to move this with only Democratic votes. He wants to move it through regular order, which would require him to get at least 60 votes in the Senate. Do Democrats really think they can get there? What is their strategy to get there? And then, I guess, is the backup that you do go and you say, okay, we couldn't reach a bipartisan deal, or we couldn't get enough Republicans for a bipartisan deal, so we're going to do this as part of the budget process that allows us to get past them, even though that adds some time and would restrict your ability to do certain things like the minimum wage?
Yeah, I can't speak to what they're thinking of in terms of their legislative strategy here. You know, I do think it's notable that the explicit proposal here, as you said, was to try to move this through regular order, right? There have been calls to try to do this through reconciliation or, you know, as we talked about earlier, even moving past the filibuster as a constraint on legislative packaging. You know, I think We'll see how this plays. I'm encouraged to hear what Lanhi said. If there are votes to be had from the GOP, I think it's so critically needed. You know, I think there it's worth noting some of the things that are not in here that if this were like a full bore kind of from the left bill, you'd expect a few other things in here too that are not in the bill. For example, a number of the policies are not automatically renewing. They sort of sunset, right, either in September or in a year. We can debate whether or not that's the best way forward on the merits, but I do see that as, you know, something of a concession to, you know, treating this as a more bipartisan, you know, relief package as opposed to sort of a kind of a long-term major remaking of our economic and social policies. And the price tag, you know, you mentioned, yes, it's big, but it's still quite small compared to the estimates of the output gap. You know, the best estimates now is that given the severity of the crisis, we're talking a $3 to $4 trillion gap in our economy. And this proposal is coming in at, you know, greater than $1 trillion.
Well, it's almost $2 trillion, and we just did $900 billion last month.
So we've got another less than trillion to go.
Zeynep, I wanted to ask you about the one key element of this is significant money for state and local governments for testing and vaccine distribution. You've done a lot of really great writing on this over the last year in a way that, first of all, I was wondering if you could talk about, I mean, it's not your field, but if you go back and read what you were writing in March, it holds up a lot better than what public health experts in many cases were writing back in March, for example, about the use of masks. So I'm wondering if you could talk about like how you approach, you know, trying to, you know, develop a view on what the government is doing right and wrong here, and then specifically whether you see a big, you know, slug of cash from the federal government as one of the key things that's missing in the government response that we've had.
So I think thank you for the kind words, and I mean the way we failed is very complicated. It has a lot of top-down elements. Clearly, the Trump administration basically impeding its own progress or our ability. I think the only thing they did right was probably try to speed up vaccination development, but they are screwing that up with the slow distribution that we're seeing, because vaccines by themselves aren't magic. It's vaccination we need. So, but you're right. I think that the problem goes deeper than just Trump. It's pretty clear that I think our public health infrastructure is very weak, which is not good. It's also that our public health expertise is not been functioning very well. And I don't mean just the Trump administration. We've seen a lot of what I would call paternalism, not really leveling with people and sort of trying to micromanage the message for what behavior we want rather than just sort of being a lot more straight with it. And I'm really kind of encouraged that the incoming, one of the things that the Biden administration and the incoming CDC director, one of the things she's emphasized is like, we're going to level with you. So I'm hoping that's a recognition by them that this has been a problem with masks, with the kind of moralistic outrage over outdoors or the beach outrage and all of those things that were just completely counterproductive and unscientific, not leveling with the people about the mask shortage. So here we are. But again, it's complicated because the administration itself has been making it very hard for the public health experts to do what they could do. But it's important to note, like, even Europe's not doing very well, right? It's not just Trump administration. We're seeing a crisis in most of Europe. So I think there's a bigger Western Europe and United States crisis here in not being ready for a SARS-like pandemic that East Asia was much more ready for because they have been through SARS and they were able to act earlier on. So to go back to the money question, right now, it's a terrible time because we're facing a new variant that has emerged. And I just wrote an article, why aren't we, like, it's been a year, why aren't we wearing better masks? I mean, cloth masks are fine as a stopgap measure, but, you know, we're not wearing higher grade masks, which would do a better job of protecting people. It's kind of ridiculous that we're still discussing these things. So money will help, I think. It's kind of late in the game, but we have one good, like, silver bullet, which is the vaccines. And the U.S. has actually a pretty good supply, but we're not getting it into arms, partly because we don't have funding to roll it out, and partly because a lot of places have created this bureaucracy, ironically in the name of equity, but it's the kind of bureaucracy that is just the worst of both possible worlds. It's going to harm equity, but because guess who can navigate such bureaucracies better? The people with the privilege and the time and the resources to begin with. Plus, it's pretty clear it's slowing down the vaccination process. Like California, which has pretty complicated rules, and the medical board is sending letters to doctors saying, you know, if you go out of the priority line, you'll lose your license. And they're trying to be very strict. And you're already hearing cases of vaccines being wasted in California, as I think second worst in the country, right next to Alabama, in using up the supply it has. Now, I understand, like, you don't want Kim Kardashian cutting in front of everybody else and, you know, getting the vaccine before that's what they're trying to prevent. But this is not the way to prevent it, right? The way to prevent that is to roll it out by age, which is a simpler thing that is hard to game. And to go to those neighborhoods and workplaces where, you know, if you want to sort of prioritize frontline essential workers who are indeed dying younger, getting sick more, and are disproportionately, you know, African-American and Hispanic. So there's no question, like, just age alone doesn't cut it. But there's a way to do this without, you know, slowing up the whole thing. You spend that money and you have the National Guard set up tents in those neighborhoods. You go to workplaces and you vaccinate every last person in that workplace, maybe with only an age cutoff, because that's the simplest thing. You know, go to a food warehouse, go to a meatpacking plant, go to the right zip code and do proactive reaching out, which is how you get equity.
Let's leave that there. I want to thank our special guest today, Zeynep Tufekci, sociology professor at the University of North Carolina and a contributing writer at The Atlantic, where you can read her on the pandemic, the insurrection, and other topics we touched on today. Thank you, Zeynep.
Thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Lonnie Chan, it's your soapbox.
It was about a year ago today, January 14th, 2020, that the World Health Organization released its now infamous declaration that there was no evidence that a novel respiratory disease making its way through China could be transmitted between human beings. While it lauded China's response, the WHO failed to sound the alarm about a virus that would set off a pandemic that a year later is still devastating communities around the world and, of course, here in the U.S. In an awful irony, a WHO team finally arrived in Wuhan, China this week to start its investigation into the origins of the virus. But I wouldn't hold my breath for results or real cooperation from the government in Beijing anytime soon. The WHO showed its true colors last year when it parroted the Chinese government's obfuscations about the early spread of the virus. It's long past time that the U.S. and other nations work to hold the WHO accountable for doing its job. Here's to hoping that the incoming Biden administration will do that instead of giving this flawed organization a free pass.
Sabil Rahman, what's on your mind?
We've been talking a lot today about political and legal accountability for what's happened these last few weeks, but I'm also thinking a lot about on the cultural side, how do we tell the story so that as a country, we're able to both move forward and learn the lessons? You know, the historian David Blight had an op-ed last week about the lost cause of the Confederacy and how the Confederacy was able to rewrite the story of the Civil War as a victory for the South. One of the big challenges for us going forward is how do we tell the story to make sure that we learn about what really happened on January 6th, what led up to it, and reestablish the norms we need for a safe, inclusive democracy.
For my rant, vaccine distribution is speeding up. According to the Bloomberg Vaccine Tracker, the pace of vaccination in the U.S. for the 7-day period ending January 14th was about double that for the period ending January 7th. States have been increasing their flexibility about who can get the vaccine. That includes New York, whose too tight rules I complained about last week. The rules are better now. Anyone over 65 is eligible to get a vaccine right now in New York. And that added flexibility is one of the factors that is making vaccination happen faster around the country. We're distributing vaccines faster than Canada, faster than Western Europe, with the exception of the United Kingdom. It's not fast enough, but the pace is improving. And I see reasons to believe that it will continue to improve. So I'm optimistic that we will well outpace President-elect Joe Biden's promise of 100 million doses in his first 100 days. Here's hoping. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Lanhi Chen, Sabil Rahman, and Zeynep Tufekci. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is Kat Yor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.